I'm Jordan Paris, and this is Trending Up.
All right, we are live. I am here with Liz Kislick. You can find Liz. I will share my screen real quick. You can find Liz at lizkislick.com, as well as she's got columns in Forbes, Harvard Business Review, as well as Entrepreneur. I think Forbes is her most active one. She actually just put out an article 41 minutes ago. So there it is. You can look up Liz Kislick, Forbes, HBR, Entrepreneur, and to find those columns. People, I think, that listen to this are pretty resourceful. They can find it without direct links. Liz, it is a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for being here.
I'm so happy LinkedIn to be Live. With you.
Yeah. So first off, you know, I ask this every so often to people who have columns in all of the columns that you would want to have columns in. You know, it's not something that I really do too often, you know, blogging, and I don't even know that I'd be a good fit for it, but like, you know, I think it would be like many people think it would be like a cool thing to do, to have a column in something like Forbes, Harvard Business Review, or Entrepreneur. So, you know, what question is coming? You know, I think for me, like, I've always dreamed about writing about the intersection between podcasting and entrepreneurship and featuring people who like really do that very well. And, you know, so, well, okay, like, why don't I just do that on my blog? Well, it's not as cool. But anyway, how did you become a contributor at some of these publications? Which was first, and how did the opportunities arise?
I've actually been writing for my own blog for about 10 years, and that's every week. And before
every
there
week.
I take off for the Christmas New Year's period.
Right.
But other than that, yeah.
Nice.
So there's a lot of content there. And before there was blogging, I used to write for a variety of direct marketing industry publications. I come out of that neighborhood originally. So I was used to not only generating content, but also being edited. And that's really a big key, because if you, these high profile publications, you have to please a group of editors. It's not
really
just the thing you want to do yourself. That you can do, you know, on your blog, and you can do it on LinkedIn. And there are a variety of publications that are good starters, because there's kind of a laddering process that often works, you know, because you need to be able to show an editor the quality of your writing, and they need to see that it's published. It's not just what you submit. So,
I see.
It's not automatic.
So, how specifically then? I get the principle behind it, but like, how specifically did one of these opportunities arrive?
Okay, so I'll tell you about Forbes, because you were so on the case that you knew that a piece went up today, which just cracks me up.
So on the case.
Yeah. So with Forbes, it was really interesting, because I knew somebody who knew somebody who had written on my behalf to, I forget who, at Forbes, and they turned me down. And this was that I was already in Harvard Business Review, but they turned me down.
Wow.
And they did not like my stuff. I don't know.
I'm surprised, you know, with that kind of social proof in HBR already, that they wouldn't want to keep up with the Joneses.
So I was surprised too. But one of the things about editorial is they all have their own way. And even different editors within the same publication will have differences. So there is a kind, you know what it makes me think of? On the various detective shows, when a detective picks up in homicide, that's the one who has the case. So whichever editor you happen to hit, sometimes it's a match. And sometimes they don't feel that way.
I see.
But then later, a good colleague of mine was approached by Forbes, and she was already writing for a couple of other publications, and she said no. She said what you would say. You want to talk to my friend. So then I submitted, and you have to submit published articles and pitches for new articles. And that time they took me. And I can't tell you why, Jordan.
Mm. With the analogy, the detective analogy, you know, it's whoever picks up the case. I think it's very much like that with TED Talks too.
Mm.
I get rejected many times. I get the screenshots of, you know, rejection emails but eventually I got a yes. And eventually you did too. I mean, did you go through a similar process there? Did you get rejected a few times? Yeah.
And different places. And it feels arbitrary.
Hmm.
I'm sure they have their rubric, their rationale, their checklist. To the person who's submitting, it's very hard to know, and they often don't give you information that's really useful for changing their approach.
Yeah, I find that too.
Yeah.
It's, I guess, just keep knocking on the door. Keep knocking on doors, plural form.
I think that's right. And then trying to see what are the approaches that seem to be successful, and can you reverse engineer it in some way? But even that's not guaranteed. You know, I don't mean to suggest that there is actually a checklist that you can follow to submit.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of articles online all the time about how to get published in A, B, C, or D. And it's worth looking at them. But then it is the same as pitching for anything else. You have to be willing to do it and be turned away and go back. And you know, it's not up to us. There are loads of people with good content.
Yeah. I think getting published a feature is much different than, you know, getting a column. But as far as getting a column is it unheard of, Liz, to, and, you know, I'm not making you the expert on Forbes columns, but I'm asking, if you don't know the answer, that's fine. Is it unheard of to be gifted a column, to get a yes without writing for any other publications besides your own blog?
Do you have
some sort of leverage elsewhere? Okay.
I really don't know. And I think it depends on what's going on in the moment too. Because in the same way that you might meet somebody on the street corner and suddenly they're your partner for life because it just happened to be your lucky day, you might hit it. But in general, I think it's not meant to be so easy. Editors are drowning in content.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And a lot of it's very similar too. You know, I think that, you know, a lot of the, it's sometimes hard to find original messages out there. I actually just tweeted something about an hour ago. When creating content, avoid cliche like the plague. And I think that if you're avoiding the cliche, you know, you're pitching something that is original a little bit, and not, you know, and 200 contributors aren't already writing about this, it's obviously, without saying, you know, boost your chances. Now, is it overrated, you know, or is it well worth the, you know, writing the articles, you know, having these columns?
You know, this is like the thing about, do you stop taking the medication? So I don't know if I stopped writing, would I still be getting the business I get, et cetera? I'll tell you that, I have only gotten one client who saw a piece in Harvard Business Review, emailed me, and we were a match, and there we were right there. I have gotten inquiries, not always the perfect match, or, as is true in many cases, people write to writers to get answers for things. So it's not necessarily going to turn into business. But I think in general, it probably adds, we have to assume it adds cachet for just the reason you made the intro you made, right?
Yeah. It's, I mean, there's an element of social proof there too that yes. And I mean, we look to the actions of others to determine the best path or the best behavior a lot of the time. And if Forbes and Harvard Business Review and Entrepreneur are doing it, then it must be good. If they trust you, then I can trust you.
We have to hope that's true.
Well, yes. So social proof, look, you know, the caveat to social proof, the disclaimer is, you know, it is a great human mechanism. It informs a lot of our decisions for the reasons I just mentioned. And I mean, a lot of times it's a safe path, you know, following the actions of others. But we cannot blindly rely on social proof all the time. That can get us into trouble. You know, you look to the example that Dr. Cialdini mentions in his book Influence, you know, the Jonestown mass suicide. Everyone committed suicide because the leader said so, and everyone else was committing suicide, so I'll commit suicide too. You know, really, it's an extreme example, but we can't always blindly follow social proof. So, Liz, we'll make a hard shift to more of your topic of expertise, and you know, that's people. You know, you're a management consultant. What about self-care for leaders? You know, I mentioned before we got on here my great morning, you know, getting up at 6:30 and exercising and reading and walking on the beach and meditating there, and did some bike riding too, and all before like 8 a.m. It was great. And what kind of self-care for leaders do you recommend? Like, how do you prevent burnout? I mean, because even with all that, like, I've definitely felt maybe not like complete burnout, but you know, not feeling too hot about everything type of feeling. How do you prevent that? What kind of things do you recommend?
They're two different things. They work together sometimes, but they are actually two different things, because self-care is like putting deposits into the bank. You're strengthening yourself, and if you're taking actions that are right for you, theoretically, you're also making yourself more resilient. And some of the things that you referred to, the exercise, the meditation, those are fabulous. I also recommend them, and I also worked out this morning. And there's no question, it gives you a boost in mood.
The exercise turns me around so quickly.
It's funny. Remarkable. Part of it is, I think, those of us who are in the realm of, let's call it, knowledge workers, we're leading from our heads. And particularly if we're using a keyboard, you end up crunching yourself up so much that you actually diminish yourself in physical size. Yes. And your brain reads that as being shrunken weakness, you know? So then you don't even feel
as safe. I so agree with
that.
It really does. I believe in that 100%.
Yeah.
Your brain really detects that and responds accordingly. Yes.
So the idea of and this sounds so small as to be ridiculous, but just lifting your head out of your shoulders right away. Now, you already drew the breath, but even before you breathe, the fact that it's safe to put your head up and not get it shot at, okay, I'm safe. Good. I can look around. Now maybe I can take a full breath. And the issue is not even so much taking the breath as the exhale, because a longer exhalation, the fact that your body has time to do it and doesn't have to pant the way it would if you were being chased, again, it's a message to the brain that you're safe. So how your body is, very important. Meditation or anything that clears the mind, for just a couple of seconds of all that ongoing chatter, all those voices we have. Great. Something you didn't happen to mention, I won't ask you, you'll say if you want to, sleep. Okay. I don't do that enough, but it is healing both psychologically and physically. There's no question.
Yeah.
Nature.
I talk about sleep all day though. I mean, 10 o'clock to 6:30, 7, the latest, at least lately. And I mean, it's not the same as like, oh, I'll sleep. I'll go to bed at 2, wake up at 8, and I'll take like, naps throughout the day. It's not the same. I don't have any caffeine because I don't like that to interfere with my sleep cycles. I mean, because think about it.
Super.
You have like 200 milligrams of caffeine at, let's say, like 10 a.m. And then so the half-life of caffeine, 6 hours. Sorry, I'm going on here. Half-life of caffeine, 6 hours at 4 p.m., you got 100 milligrams buzzing around in your system still. And then at 10 o'clock, 6 hours later, you still got 50 milligrams buzzing around your system. I don't want 50 milligrams in my system when I'm like trying to go to bed. I'm trying to hit my sleep cycles in an optimal way, and I don't really want that interfering. I mean, like, there's a difference between passing out and actually going to sleep. And I find that a lot of people, not everyone, it works for some people, but a lot of people that have way too much caffeine, they may sleep enough hours, but they wake up feeling restless and they're like, oh, I need more caffeine. And it's just a vicious cycle. So I mean, sleep is so important. The quickest way to depression for me is to get under 6 hours of sleep.
Okay, good. And under 6 hours is really unhealthy in almost every way you can look at it. But even if you're doing those mechanical things, that's not enough to stave off burnout if you are throwing yourself into an uncomfortable, unpleasant, painful circumstance every single day. So your conditions, the way you do your work, the people you're with, the requirements and burdens that you feel, if those become too crushing for too long, we can tolerate a lot. I mean, it's quite remarkable what we can tolerate and slog through and still do quite well. But at some point, it catches up with you. So in addition to the good, healthy things, you need a certain amount of pleasure and beauty. Nature is fabulous for that. Art and music are all wonderful. But you also need to get some satisfaction out of what you're doing and feel good about it, in the sense that you have to feel that your work is needed. That's a very big component of it, and appreciated. So you can know, for example, there are people who are in truly terrible jobs and have, there are some terrible bosses out there, and they know their work is needed, but it doesn't feel good to do. And after a while, they start to fry.
What do you do?
Well, you look and see carefully whether there are things you can change or whether it's best to go. That's the big equation. If there are things you can change, then it's worth experimenting and trying in exactly the same way that we talked about pitching publications. You try to figure out, because everything is like that. Jordan, everything is like that, right?
Yeah.
You quite size it up.
Quite the metaphor for life,
Yeah, you size it up, you see what you can tweak or think fresh or shift or get help with or any of those things. You run the experiment, and if it works, you think, okay, that's good. Now what can I do next? But if you've run a dozen experiments, or you gave yourself 6 months to experiment and it still really is awful, then it just makes sense to think, what are my other options? Because misery is bad in general.
It's bad,
And right now, between the pandemic, which is not leaving us anytime soon, and the heightened awareness in the white world of racial justice and all the problems that our Black and other people of color colleagues have been laboring under, there's a lot of negative energy, pressure, and suffering right now.
Yeah.
And you put something yucky about your job on top of that, you can feel pretty bad for a pretty long time.
Mm. Yeah. Regarding the, you mentioned the burden, carrying the load. I think as leaders, I especially have a tendency to, you know, it's easier for me to just do it for someone instead of explaining it, or, and so I just take on a lot of the time too much. And obviously it's the cliche problem that leaders have, you know, the issue of not being able to delegate. And I've certainly been able to delegate a lot more in the past year than I have been ever, you know, where I do very little fulfillment at this point. You know, I produce podcasts at Trend Up Media. It's my company. And, but still there's like little things that like, I just shouldn't be doing. How do we like, how do we, instead of solving problems for our team, how do we empower them to take initiative and solve the problems themselves?
Good. You are very good at asking two questions in one question.
Oh, that's not good. That's a bad thing. Thanks for making me aware of that. I gotta.
Well, it's great for making it interesting. You may not get the answers you want. So delegating and empowering are actually, you know, in the Venn diagram, there's an overlap, but they're not the same thing at all. Because delegating is really about resource management, clarity of instruction. It's structural. Then the idea of empowerment, that's really the way you treat people. Because, so I used to talk about empowerment as the thing that leaders would talk about to hold people responsible for what they themselves would have done if they had been in that circumstance with perfect resources, perfect information, and perfect good luck. That's empowerment. You know, that was their idea of empowerment. Here, I'm giving it to you to do. Now go be perfect so that I will be satisfied. And what a bind that is. Sure. To put somebody in. So in many ways, knowing how to delegate is really important to empowerment, because if you don't know how to give clear instruction, and most of us don't, I don't know if when you were in, middle school, if you ever had the exercise of describing to somebody else how to make a peanut butter sandwich or how to tie their shoes, and the number of things that we gloss over because it's so obvious, we don't think about it.
Right.
You know, we don't say, take the lid off the jar, and we don't describe how you do that.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
I struggle with that. Yes.
How do we know it?
Other than being aware, what else do we do?
Right. So part of the challenge, particularly for people who are competent, are quick, and want it done the way they would do it, we sometimes don't know how to think about explaining the thing so that somebody who is not us can do it. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest issues, and here's why the two questions together actually works. One of the biggest issues in both delegation and empowerment is understanding that the other person is not us.
Yeah.
So when you empower somebody, you are leaving them with trust and confidence. You are really giving it to them in a way that means you expect that you will actually be pleased when you get it back. And if you don't believe that, don't think you're empowering.
Mm.
First, make sure they actually have the knowledge and the skills and the resources and the tools and the bandwidth and all the other things. What goes wrong so often is a leader says, oh, my people aren't accomplishing X. I have to empower them to do it. And then he says, oh, people, I have your backs. You are empowered. Go do it. Well, if they don't have new tools or they don't have new information, they're probably going to do exactly the thing they did last week. And we believe that when we say we're empowering, that it should come out better, golden and shining, you know. But there's a lot that goes into that. So in either of these cases, thinking about what is the result that you are looking for, and have you created the conditions in which that result is likely to occur, is what you really should be asking yourself.
Okay. Thank you. Liz, you've answered my questions today, and I thank you for that. People can find you again at lizkislick.com, as well as your columns, Liz Kislick, Forbes, Harvard Business Review, Entrepreneur, and people can find you on LinkedIn as well and connect with you there.
Sure.
Liz, thank you very much. I appreciate you.
Jordan, it's been so nice to be with you.
Yes.